Welcome back to Half Wits and Failed Crits. I have with me Luis.
I'm Luis, and I play Nixter.
Kylie.
I'm Kylie, and I play Malara.
And Mary.
I'm Mary, and I play Adriel.
Laura is MIA today. She had plans, and I did poor planning, so we're going to record this without her, unfortunately. This is going to be the last of three summary episodes that we are giving to you guys before we kick off with the actual play podcast part of this thing. And yeah, I think we can just kick it right off. We've got three different games to recap, starting with our game number 8, which was First Contact.
Game 8, First Contact. Another day, another quest for the Syndicate. Well, some of them anyway. Suffering from a terrible hangover from the previous night's tavern visit, Anya sleeps the day away in her hammock while Kef and Bradley have a boys' day. The quest this time is one to ease tensions between the Karalu and Gretton villages of half a day's travel away from Hollistead. Adriel, Malara, and Nixtern set out, choosing to stop at the Karalu first. As they approach, they see a small village with very few structures, surrounded by sprawling farmlands. As they walk the main street, they notice that there are no bars or restaurants, to Nixtern's disappointment. Adriel quickly notices that the townsfolk are a majority of tieflings. Malara listens in on nearby couple's conversation and hears that the folks from Gretton village are mining under the farmlands, creating sinkholes that swallow whole fields of crops and even livestock. From what they are able to gather from the townsfolk, the dwarves of Gretton are doing this intentionally, trying to drive the citizens of Karalu from the land, just because they're tieflings. The group goes looking for someone to tell them more about the tensions between the villages, and eventually they are directed to the village elders. Several old and faded tieflings sit in high chairs overseeing the management of the town. But when Adriel asks about the tensions with Gretton, the elders claim not to know anything about it. Feeling slightly defeated, the group heads out, wondering if they should go to Gretton, when Adriel overhears a group of mercenaries talking in a barn. She approaches, and they inform her that Gretton may be planning an attack on Karalu. Adriel tells Malara and Nixtern what she's learned, and they quickly decide they have to stop the invasion. But how? Of course, Adriel suggests assassinating the Gretton leader. Nixtern seems to want to fight the entire village of dwarfs, while Malara hopes to find a more peaceful solution. The trio quickly head out towards Gretton, hoping to intercept the attackers and persuade them to stop. Somewhere in the woods between the two villages, the group finds the attacking Gretons. Despite Malara's best attempts at reasoning with them, they will not be deterred from what they see as saving their village from the influence of the devilish tieflings. Adriel, of course, gets offended, and her and Nixtern, who is always ready for a fight, attacks the dwarves. Realizing she and her friends are badly outnumbered, Malara casts Conjure Animals and summons 8 wolves into existence. Hopefully this will even the odds. In the midst of fighting the dwarves, the trio hears the bells in Hollistead start to ring, summoning all the guild members to the guild hall for important assignments. Adriel heavily argues that defending the tieflings is more important, as they are virtually defenseless against the dwarves, and Nixtern really just wants to stay where the fighting is. Malara, concerned that there will be heavy punishment, decides to shapeshift and fly into the guild hall to represent the syndicate, and explains where the others are. Unfortunately, upon her arrival, she is told that it doesn't matter that the syndicate is defending a village on a guild hall quest. If they aren't all there, the whole guild is delinquent. Now extremely annoyed, Malara decides to return to her guild and help rather than try to please the guild hall. Heck yeah. The syndicate is able to subdue the remaining dwarves and convince them to return to their village and make them promise not to attack Karalu again. I'm fairly certain Nixtern made some very threatening remarks here, and Adriel probably intimidated them a lot. Eventually, the trio turns toward Tree Tower, hoping to get a good night's sleep before the guild hall delivers their punishment. While trekking home, the group notices what appears to be a large rift bubble, unlike any they had seen before. It almost looks like a large circular dome, covering part of the road. On the inside of the purple glowing and swirling bubble, there are 3 humanoid figures. As the trio move around, they notice the figures in the rift are copying their movements. After playing some very difficult charades, Nixtern places his hand against the side of the bubble, and his copycat does as well, passing a small circular object through the rift to Nixtern. Nixtern places it in his magical gauntlet and turns it into a ring. Slowly, the bubble condenses until it blinks out of sight, and the trio hasten to Hollistead to tell the guildmasters about this strange rift. However, they are told to never tell anyone about this event. This causes some suspicions within the group as they return to Tree Tower, but they decide they'll deal with it once they know what their punishment will be for ignoring the guild call.
Game 9, The Varethi Affair. Several days pass as the guild waits impatiently for Master Nim from the guild hall to send word that the punishment is ready. Luckily, this has given everyone a chance to tidy up around Tree Tower. Just kidding. Nixtern admired his head collection, Malara studied, Adriel practiced her knife work, and Anya drank. Finally, Master Nim's assistant, Kilatair, a drow, comes to the guild and informs them that, as it was their first infraction and they're not on probation, they have a special task that they have to complete. He tells them that they have to be on guard duty for a coming-of-age gala for the drow twins, Edessa and Garen Varethi. They are told to go a couple towns outside of Halestead to a town where they're told, "You'll know it when you see it." They've been told to speak with the butler, and he'll give them instructions. Malara does some pretty quick research and preparation and learns that there are close to 100 different drow families in this area. The Varethis are an important drow family, so this gala will be attended by all the highest of drow society. Adriel looks into the Varethi family. Bannis and Morelli are the parents of Edessa and Garen and are throwing the celebration. Bannis' sister Tils, her husband Lero Rendas, and their children Arvel and Carla also live in the Varethi Manor. Another major family that will be in attendance is the Omarin family, which is Marilli's brother, Delos, and his wife, as well as their twin daughters, Nurise and Verona. The DM tells us that the identical female twins are super rare among the drow, and as they're coming out in a couple months as well, there's a pretty heavy concern that they'll overshadow Edessa. After researching as much as they can in preparation, they set off for the Varethi Manor, where they meet the butler, who then informs them that because the syndicate did not answer the summons, the Varethi sent some of their guards to deal with a nearby rift, and they were badly injured. So now we have to be their guards for the evening. One duty is to man the door, checking the guest list as guests arrive, but we can't offend anyone by making them wait at the door, so we have to be real quick. At this point, Jonathan hands all three of us about 10 sheets of paper with several columns, each of the most complicated made-up drow names he could seem to find. As guests begin to arrive, their heralds announce them, and the group scrambles to look up the names as the drows just breeze on past. At this point, I'm pretty certain Jonathan just kept going faster with all the names to make it even harder. They end up turning away two families, but are fairly certain that imposters manage to sneak in anyway. The butler returns to take them to get appropriately dressed, and out of character, we spent about 15 minutes trying to decide what awesome outfits our imaginary characters were changing into. The butler then takes them into the ballroom where the dancing is just beginning. Adriel suggests spreading out to better observe everyone, so they set up patrol areas. Malara overhears that Morelli and Delos are the only members of the Varethi family that don't always get along, and Adriel rolls poorly on her perception check and doesn't discover anything, while Anya decides to introduce herself to Edessa and Garen. On the left side of the stage is Garen, who looks physically formidable, and Anya immediately falls in love. It might be time to divorce Bill. Edessa looks very prim and proper, but it really appears forced. So Malara and Adriel poke around their patrols, but they don't really find anything of interest. I think Adriel helped an old lady get off the dance floor, but that's pretty much it. Anya sees Nerissa and Verona nearby and decides to go try and flirt, and I mean by that I mean talk, with them, but quickly realizes that they are very self-centered. She gets approached by a cousin of the Varethis, who tells her that someone is here that shouldn't be, Dulcil from House Dilmello. Anya sends Pants to retrieve Malara and Adriel and informs them of this development. Meanwhile, Adriel sees someone trying to sneak out the side door from the gala, but can't tell who it is from this distance. So Anya goes back to Nurise and Verona to ask some more questions, but they have such snotty attitudes that she quickly tries a different tactic. Approaching Marilli, Anya tells her about their suspicion that Dulcil is here and gets a description of him. Upon learning this, Adriel realizes the figure that slipped out of the ballroom earlier seemed to fit that description and heads out to investigate. As she leaves, a commotion breaks out on the dance floor. Marilli had heard all the catty things Nerissa and Verona had said and was confronting their mother, who doesn't seem to understand why she's angry at all. Luckily, the elder drow are able to calm things down. In the gardens, Adriel does indeed find Dulcil, who doesn't understand why he wasn't invited to the party. And he definitely doesn't get why she was told he wasn't allowed to see Edessa, as he's much closer to Garen. Wink, wink. Adriel feels bad for him and decides to let him stay, not telling Anya or Malara. Rude. Inside, everyone heads in for dinner, and it's security's worst nightmare with balconies, badly lit hallways, and terraces galore. Again, the group decides to spread out for a better view. Adriel heads up to the rafters to watch from above, while Anya watches the front and Malara watches the back. Suddenly, Adriel feels a smelly cloth drop over her face and everything goes black. Down below, Anya realizes that four of the immediate family members are not at the table, so Malara glances around to see if anyone is sneaking out and then realizes that Adriel is gone. She quickly turns into a tiny elf owl to go search for her, but maybe it wasn't the best idea to leave Anya alone on guard duty. Adriel wakes up tied to a chair and blindfolded. She tries to reach for a dagger, but is stopped, and she doesn't recognize the voices. She then proceeds to act as annoying as she possibly can, and the captors leave her alone. In the dining room, Anya sees all but Verona return to the table and goes to look. Adriel, meanwhile, has managed to get her knife out and free herself. And in the hallway, she finds Anya and Malara looking for her. And Verona, but mostly Adriel. They return to the dining room, hoping Verona did too, when Malara notices that one of the cooks doesn't have the exact same uniform as all the rest, and is instantly suspicious. Anya has pants restrain the cook, while Malara casts detect poison, and his whole cart lights up. Adriel yells out that there's poison, and the cook yells back that it's his job. He deals with the pufferfish and the other dangerous foods. And suddenly, a body falls from the chandelier. Verona's lifeless body hits the floor and panic erupts. The syndicate lock down all the doors and exits. No one is leaving until this is figured out. Anya checks the bodies while Adriel sneaks out and confronts Dalsil again, and he's shocked when she tells him Verona is dead. Anya gathers three guests that were missing before, and Adriel asks them all to say something, as she thinks that maybe she can recognize the kidnappers' voices if she hears them again. Vaneth, who is Odessa's great-grandmother, sounds slightly familiar, and upon further questioning, Adriel realizes that she sounds like an older version of the woman who trapped her. Thinking it could have been her daughter, maybe, whose name is Mayra, or even Marilli, the group goes to bring them in for questioning, when Vaneth sighs and confesses to hiring someone to do it. She said she couldn't stand to see Marilli and Delos fighting all the time, and thought that maybe this would even things out and bring the family closer together. Such a bad plan. The crew tie her up and get the family members together to let them decide what to do next. They want her punished, so the syndicate decide to take her to the jail. And as they are leaving the house, Adriel secretly tells Garen that his boyfriend is in the garden, and he holds up a small note that says he knows, but he can wait. So they head out and honestly tell Master Nim what happened, and then take Vaneth to jail. The end.
Cool. And now we got our last game before real playing, which is game number 10. Game 10 was called Maiden Voyage, and it started out a little different than all of them. I had everyone do individual scenes, so we're going to have people read their individual scenes. Starting with Malara.
Oh.
It's been a few months since the incident at the Varethi Manor, and the Syndicate takes some time for themselves, something they haven't done since becoming a guild.
Malara's taking some rare downtime to spend some quality time with Dart. There's an abandoned village not too long a journey away that she brought him to once before. The buildings are sturdy enough for him to jump up, and the central pond is great for wading around and keeping his skin moist with little effort on her own part. Dart also likes it for the opportunity to indulge his more feral instincts by attempting to catch the large avian creatures that regularly fly overhead. Soon, the peace is interrupted as Malara hears the marching and chatter of a decently sized group of people. Malara ducks into a building and doesn't have enough time to get Dart out of the water. Hopefully, he'll stay under until the group passes through. Unfortunately, it becomes clear that the group was using this village as a staging site for a larger meaning. Malara decides to come out and introduce herself before Dart can startle the group. They are treasure hunters and are fairly friendly. They explain that they have three maps and need to split up to cover more ground. There's a rich man handing out this job to whoever he sees, and they want to get the prize first, so keeping Malara in the loop is better than giving her reason to become competition. So she sets off with the party heading to the mountains. They find plenty of trinkets in the caves that the map pointed out, and she happily gathers what she and Dart can hold, which is plenty. When they get back to the abandoned village, the three groups split up the treasure, but no one seems too happy. The bounty flyer has three specific items in mind, a belt, a totem, and a locket, and none seem to be present in the hall. Taking a closer look, Malara recognizes two things. The sketch of the locket is her mother's, which is currently tucked into her blouse. The second thing was the bounty owner, Lord Montagore, the man who killed Malara's mother and father, and the reason her mother hid the locket with Malara.
Anya spent her time like she does all free time. Another day, another drink, or two, or ten. Anya can't remember. Does it even matter? Slowly or quickly, a lot or a little, strong or weak, nothing is shaking her anxiety. Why would Adriel lie to everyone? Lying to the Varethi family, if anyone asked, is one thing. Anya probably would have lied herself if it came to it, but to fellow guild leaders? No guild members? No! Friends? Adriel lied to her friends. And even though Anya knows it had little to do with Verona being murdered, she can't shake that any bit of information could have given everyone just a little more time to prevent it. Anya climbed her way back up to her hammock, pants frequently teleporting to catch a missed branch here, a stumble there. Safely swaying in her hammock, Anya watches as the first faint hints of dawn start to redden the horizon. Staring up at the stars, she sighs and tries to decide. Did Adriel's lie kill Verona? Or did you all fail together? Or does it not matter what happened to Verona? Adriel's lie hurt her. As she thinks about her choices, the stars above seem to begin to dance in her vision. Must be her drunk self starting to get the sways from laying down. Though as she focuses, it turns out there are lights dancing, fireflies buzzing about in rhythmic movements. Movements that seem to change after being noticed. One after another, they leapfrog into a line that guides Anya down tree tower's branches out to the woods. The flitting bugs bring her through a small swamp and through a tangle of trees and brush that eventually opens up to a small clearing at the base of a small rock face. Anya thinks she sees a glimmer at the top, different from the fireflies, and begins to climb. As she reaches the final ledge, she gets better footing and sees what lies just ahead. A beautiful, bright, white horse. Anya pulls herself up and reaches towards the horse when an arrow zips past and strikes it in the side, killing it. As it falls, she notices that as it bucked in agony and fell in death, its radiant horn glimmered in the light of dawn, following the arrow's trajectory back to its source, and Anya spots the killer. It's Celine, Anya's friend, turned rival, turned murder victim. What did Anya do that early morning many, many years ago? That's right, she pushed Celine off the cliff, and that is what she does again. As Anya sits back and observes what just conspired, she sees not Celine, but Adriel. She turns and sees not the unicorn, but Verona on the ground. Anya wakes up in her hammock, pants tucked close to her side.
You murderer.
I keep one sad kid secret, and you all turn against me. Adriel finds herself reflecting on how far she's come in life, and how much further she has to go. Late one night, once she was certain that the others were asleep, she exited her room and made sure to repair the disguise of its entrance and began a stroll in the dark. Tonight is a night that she prefers to be alone, and the close proximity of Tree Tower, even in her secret room, leaves much to be desired. As Adriel meanders from tree to tree, the forest just gets more and more dense. Tripping on roots in the dark becomes a more common occurrence, enough to be too irksome for tonight of all night. With the huff, she climbs the trees up to their canopy and breaks its claustrophobic barrier ever so slightly with her wings. Hovering just above the treetops, the moon glistens off and through Adriel's infernal wings, refracting icy blue onto the pale surface. She hears a faint cry for help. Scanning the area, Adriel can see a dimly lit hut at the top of a large hill. At the bottom of the hill is where the pleas originate. She doesn't know whether it's frustration or this specific night, but she decides to heed the cries. An older human man looks to have fallen and twisted or maybe even broken his leg. It's hard to tell since he is so frail looking. On a small hill just to his side is a well, and it looks as though he fell down the bluff while fetching a lot of water. His cart with many barrels lays just to the side. Adriel loads the man onto the cart and wheels it according to his directions. But she didn't need them, as Adriel already saw the hut he came from. Up close, the hut appears much larger than she initially perceived. The squeaking of the wheels and the groaning of the man elicits a reaction from the home. Another man walks up with a lantern, profusely thanks her, and rushes the injured man inside. The other man turns to ask if she could please wheel the water just a little further to the shed if that isn't too much of a bother. As she does, Adriel hears more squeaking, not from the cart, but from the house windows. It seems as though the old man woke more than just his partner, as dozens of small soft faces stared down sheepishly from behind the windows. One particular soft face catches Adriel's attention as it's the only one with horns, and the only one with eyes so wide as she beams down at her. She's giving me 02 vibes. As Adriel walks away, a small sign pointing towards the cabin reads, "Orphanage, all welcome."
It's a killing time. There hasn't been nearly enough killing since Nick's turn created the syndicate with his friends. I didn't create the syndicate.
With your friends?
But we did with my friends, yes. The adventures are fun, but some of them are just far too strict about the level of blood they are willing to spill. Time to take matters into his own hands. Nixtern finds his way to what he thinks is an ocean. He's never seen one before, and frankly, he isn't sure you know what makes an ocean an ocean. But this body of water is really hard to see across, so that must be an ocean. Nick's turn sees there is no life nearby, so it must be underwater, and he dives in. There's small surface fish, meaning nothing to him. Deeper. Down. Down further, there are some shelled creatures, but still too small. Deeper. As Nixtern gets down farther and farther, his breath is definitely running thin, but Nixtern will not come up empty-handed even once. Deeper! He gets deep enough that there seems to be a body of water under the water. This is it. Where the real creatures live. As Nixtern plunges through the dense, deep, dark water, a light shines through. It's an underwater village, and there are people. Fish people! Using the last of his energy to kill as many as he can, Nixtern passes out and floats to the top.
Fuck you.
Just find a village and then slaughter everyone? All right.
Yeah, you did. That's exactly what
I thought
did.
It was the worms that exactly. Maybe it's
no,
later.
You killed the mermaid.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, okay. Floats to the top, where he is washed up on the opposite shore. Stupid small ocean. Nixtern ventures out into the desert before him. It's hot. It's very hot. Where are the things to kill? Nixtern walks in the sands until he feels that something is moving underneath his feet. Throwing his rapier as hard as he can down into the sand, he lands a hit. He pulls the rapier out, and on the bottom is a giant wriggling worm. You pull at it harder, and its full length rips from the sand. It is a worthy kill. 100 feet long or longer. He doesn't know or care. After wrestling it to the ground, Nixtern repeatedly snaps its spine, since it didn't die once he ripped off what he thought was the head. There is more wriggling below you, and Nixtern sees more wriggling in the sands. He rips out another worm, and a whole mess of worms comes out from the ground. It's a king of worms. So many desert worms. Nixtern kills them all until he passes out from dehydration. Nixtern wakes up when the blood of his enemies drips into his mouth, providing just enough water to get his body home. Heading back to the tree tower with his many trophies, he plops them down on his bedroom shelf. When you turn to leave, you spot a small translucent creature. It seems to be darting back and forth along the same path. Nixtern feels like he's seen this before and calls out to the rest of the group. Hello.
The syndicate follows the path of the rift creature, but don't hear any alarms coming from the guild, and it's definitely been a while. Instead of heading to the National Guild Hall, they elect to send an animal messenger to warn everyone of rift activity while continuing onward. The rift creature leads the party to a cave, and Nixtern runs in. After following some winding tunnels, they find a spacious cavern with a large pit in the ground, and see the rift creature rubber banding into the pit. Adriel flies down to check it out, and once at the bottom, a rift begins opening. Echoing from the cave tunnels comes the now familiar sound of the National Guild Hall's alarm system. Why were they so late to picking up the threat this time? Valar proposes that the party should go back to the guild hall to prevent incurring another punishment quest. Nixtern agrees, but just then, his ring starts glowing extremely bright. The rift fully opens and Anya tries to communicate with the large being forcing its way out. Unfortunately, they are too different to effectively communicate. But listening closely reveals that the group can hear faint whispers coming from inside the portal. Maybe if they were louder, they could have deciphered the language. With no time to worry about that at the present, Adriel creates a deadly poison and dumps it down the massive creature's maw. Malara, now wild-shaped into a bird, flies up to Nixtern to see his glowing ring, and he moves his arm in a circle, and a new rift opens. He moves in the opposite direction, and it closes the rift. Malara convinces Nixtern to give her the ring, and she throws it to Anya at the bottom of the pit. And Anya climbs to the edge of the maw and opens another rift directly above the creature, so that it would enter the new rift as it exits the other. While the creature is in its endless loop of rifts, the party scrambles back up the pit. The syndicate hears the second bell that signals the all clear, except their rift is still open. The party decides to wait and see if anything stops coming through. Nixtern, sick of waiting, takes action. He decides to go through the rift, leave it open, and close the original one from the inside, then return through the rift he created. The world inside is all blue and very sterile. There's nothing around. It's all flat plains. This rift happens to be on the underside of a bridge. Malara, still as a bird, flies through and closes the original portal. Then they both run through the rift they created and close it. Realizing that they didn't get any proof that they had closed the rift, they open another portal. Anya and Adriel shoot a small creature through the new rift and collect enough of the proof. As the syndicate wraps up another great rift hunting day, the poster boy from the first paradigm shows up. Norian is suspicious that they were able to close this rift on their own, but lets bygones be bygones. The syndicate heads back to Tree Tower to process the new information that they have learned about Nixturne's rift stone, and to analyze Norian's odd reaction, along with how he even knew where to find them. And that's it. We're caught up on all of the summaries. So I guess we'll do one last discussion about these last few games, and then you guys will be pretty much on to the real deal.
Woohoo!
Anyone have any lingering questions? Comments?
How do you pronounce that name?
What name?
Well, I said Karalu.
Oh, the tiefling town?
I think I said Karalu, and every other, I don't know, intonation of those letters you could possibly think of.
I think it's Karalu.
It was Karalu.
I think it's Caribou.
Ooh, Caribou. What was that Jimmy Neutron skit?
I have no idea. I was going to say Caribou Lou, the alcohol.
One thing that I want to bring up is that Kylie, when writing the Game 8 one, the first summary that we read, decided to leave out that Nick Stern's way of antagonizing the dwarf village was he picked up a child and cut it across the face.
I forgot about that.
They deserved it, though.
I'm still, it's kind of salty that I unfortunately had to keep this poor little sad child secret, and you guys all turned against me and hated me forever, and Laura / Anya actually had a revenge dream about me. Are you kidding?
She murdered you in that dream.
I know. It seems a little excessive for me trying to save this poor little kid's like heart from breaking.
But you killed them, right?
No.
Well, I think the problem was that like it was important information. It was someone who was there who wasn't supposed to be there, and you didn't tell the people you were supposed to be working with to protect a crap ton of people.
But I knew he didn't do it.
You did not.
You could
guess and hope that he didn't do it, but you couldn't know it. You didn't know this person. You never met him before.
I specifically gave Adriel, I think, two whole chances to say something to the rest of the group about this guy. And like specifically was like, do you have anything else to tell them? And she was like, no.
Yeah, and then metagame, everyone turns around and is like, what? And I'm like, sorry, y'all don't know. Adriel wouldn't have given the information up. And I seem to be the only character that can play, like, evil?
Wrong. I slashed a child in the face.
Alignment-wise, I think you
I was chaotic
are
evil.
Chaotic evil.
Yeah,
whereas,
very evil.
Huh?
I'm very evil.
That's true. Okay, take that back.
I hate you.
What is everyone?
I've always
we should mention what everyone's intended alignments are. I think I was pretty neutral on this game.
Are you sure? I
did whatever the heck I wanted.
Neutral evil is probably what I'd say.
I'm not evil though. It's all a defense mechanism because my poor little child's heart was broken when my friend died.
Which now that she says that, I'm realizing that we need to record an episode where, have separate recordings of all these guys' backstories.
That probably wouldn't hurt. I think Malara's alignment is probably closer to the like lawful good side. Mostly because...
Probably lawful good?
Hey now.
What are you saying?
Hey now. You're right. Mostly because I realized that I, as a human being, would have a really, really hard time not acting the way I normally do the first time ever playing D&D. So I purposely created a character that was as close to my own personal values as I thought I could get.
That's actually another good point. I think this is everyone's first real campaign. I don't think you played before. Mary, we had those few like college games, but they weren't super serious.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I definitely got invested in the characters that we played, but not nearly as much as Adriel. This
right.
is like I'm sad that this is our last recording of her.
Yeah. Well, you'll get to record the backstory now that we remember
You're
that.
Right. It's not the last.
Louise, how did you feel about that murder mystery game that you weren't present for?
confused. What was happening? So many names. What was accomplished there?
That was the redacted version.
But yeah, I know. Exactly. Like, what was... Like, was it, like, a noble person? Like, did anybody from that story continue on?
No. Nim. Master
secret?
Nim is one of the guild misters. Oh, stop it. He has no secret.
Oh.
She. Wait. Nim was a girl?
Yes.
You thought it was a man the whole time?
I definitely thought Nim was a dude the whole time.
Rude. He's just assuming his gender.
Her.
Her.
Oh, no. I've done it. I went and did it.
I think Nim was, like, at the party. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Nim
so,
was
like,
sloshed.
I think it was mostly Jonathan trying to figure out a game that, like, the three of us could play by ourselves.
Did you solve the murder mystery? No, the body fell from the roof, and that was it.
Yeah.
Everyone scattered.
Well, Jonathan, you might be able to tell better, but I know you had, I remember vaguely that you had said that there was one group in particular that if we hadn't turned them away, something different would have happened.
I barely remember, but you did catch one of the assassin groups, and they had to find a different way in, which you guys may have been able to catch at some point, but there
okay.
was, you know, per usual, a lot of bad rolls.
Well, yeah.
But you did let in two different groups that weren't allowed there. One of them happened to be a hitman group. One of them happened to be Garen's lover.
Well, sorry.
Which, pretty good, too, to accidentally let in. Because, like, there were a few, like, random ones that were just, like, peasants that weren't invited to this high-class event. And those were some of the ones you turned away, two of those, and then one of the hitman groups. But the other hitman group got through, and then the gay lover got through.
Well, when you read off really complicated names at light speed, it's really hard to verify them.
For your reference, Luis, we literally had 5 pages per person of 3 columns of names.
It was
and I was just read. I had the pages that I handed out to them were in a different order than the pages I had for myself. And I was just lightning reading.
He's the worst. Like, legitimately, I wanted to murder you in the middle of that game.
It was really fun.
To be completely honest. For you, maybe.
I thought you guys had fun, too, because you were, like, panicking and, like, yelling at each other, Do you have that name? But it made for fun roleplay, I think.
I had fun at this game. I remember it was really fun laughing, because eventually I think Kylie and Laura were really, really concerned. And at some point I was like, you know what? Just let them all in. Let's see what happens.
Fuck it.
All right. Anything else? Probably from the last game.
I just want to say I'm really upset that we didn't include all the times I put the ring into my butt.
Because
it was a lot. It was like 6 times in the last couple of games.
Luis, this isn't that kind of podcast.
It
yet,
is.
Okay.
It yes. is that kind of podcast.
We do mark it explicit.
It's a lot of boofing.
And all the swearing.
Specifically the boofing when Norian walks into the cage. Nick Stern took absolutely no time at all to just say, I shove it up my ass.
Yeah, that's true.
Because it was still glowing really bright. And oh, we also didn't mention in that recap that every time it like glowed, it like pulsed, like vibrated.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was guiding you guys like a compass.
Yep. And then Nick Stern just goes, I shove it up my butt.
Yep, to hide the glowing, but also it was vibrating. Yeah.
Ugh.
Okay, are we good?
Yeah.
Awesome. So thanks for listening, everybody. This is the end of the summaries, which I know you probably weren't looking for when we say that this is an actual play podcast. So we're getting onto that. We're going to edit these as we have time in our Buzzsprout account. So we pay for 3 hours, so we will upload 3 hours a month, maybe if we're feeling it, we'll throw some more money at it so that we can upload more than 3 hours a month. You can find our social media stuff at Failed Crits for Facebook and Twitter. You can send us an email at halfwitsfailedcrits@gmail.com. You can visit our website at www.halfwitsfailedcrits.com. And we have a Ko-fi, which is ko-fi.com/halfwitsfailedcrits.
Have we determined if it's Ko-fi or coffee?
It's definitely supposed to be coffee, but I absolutely can never look at it and say coffee instead of Ko-Fi.
Ah, okay.
Coffee.
I'll buy you a Ko-Fi then.
Buy me one Ko-Fi.
Speaking of Ko-Fi, I just looked at it and I really enjoy whoever wrote toss a coin to your podcast hosts.
Yeah, we already got a few donations, so that's pretty cool. Thank you for the use of our theme song, Crunk Night, by Kevin McLeod. You can find his SoundCloud in our show notes, along with other ways to contact us, donate, all that stuff. So I guess without further ado, the next episode is going to be the real deal. Thanks for listening this long, and we hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Bye.